From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Most of us living in Trump's America have that one relative or friend or neighbor who just can't help but be a racist. They may be overt in their racism or couch their views in friendlier terms. They may resort to fake news to make their point or dubious science. Given that race is a social construct on the basis of which a dominant skin-toned group systematically discriminates against the rest of us based on irrational hatred, fear, or ignorance, how does one argue with a racist? My guest, Adam Rutherford, has written a whole book about that topic. He's a geneticist, science writer, and broadcaster. He writes for the science pages of The Guardian and has written and presented many award-winning series and programs for the BBC. He's also the author of Humanimal and A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. His new book is called How to Argue with a Racist: What Our Genes Do and Don't Say About Human Difference. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Thank you for having me on, Sonali.
So we have heard this term before, this sentence that race is a social construct. But of course, for those living on the target end of racism, it feels very real when you have systemic discrimination and, you know, this idea that we all need to be colorblind is sort of pie in the sky when there continue to be very real systems of racism. So what does one mean when one says race is a social construct?
Well, that's such an important question. And sometimes it's phrased in such a way that it's an attempt to actually undermine the value of what a social construct actually means. A social construct means that it is a set of beliefs or values or judgments or whatever that are agreed socially. They're a part of the cultural sort of contracts that we all have effectively signed up for by being part of society. And it's in contrast to a biological reality. And so when we say that race is a social construct, what we mean by that is the way we talk about race today is a sort of folk taxonomy of how we understand people and how we describe people from around the world, which was built on pseudoscience in the 17th and 18th century and is now regarded as pseudoscience because what genetics says, which is the ocean from which human variation is drawn, they don't align up. The way we talk about race, the way we understand race today, doesn't align with what we understand about the biology of humans. And so race most certainly does exist. It exists because it's a social construct. And that's a very important aspect of how we interact with each other, because, you know, most human interactions are social interactions. They're not biological interactions. And you know, other things that are social constructs are money or time. But you don't get people saying, well, I'm not going to pay you because money is merely a social construct. You do get people who are, you know, effectively racist saying, well, what do you mean by that? It's, you know, saying it's just a social construct as a means of undermining what is the agreed biological understanding of race, which is that it is only social and not biological at all.
And so I want to pick up on what you said about older notions, so-called pseudoscience, that established races as being genetically different from one another. We know, sadly, that science in the past has been harnessed to justify racist beliefs. What were some of these beliefs that attempted to classify, you know, even sort of create a taxonomy of human beings based on their skin tone, which today is so much more irrelevant considering how much race mixing there actually is?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the origin of race as we currently understand it really is incredibly, you know, recent in history. It's like 17th century, and it comes at the time of European expansionism, and names that have positive attributes associated with them, positive aspects of history, such as the Age of Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution. It's also the Age of Plunder and the Age of Exploitation and the Age of European Expansionism and the Age of Subjugation of people. And so you use the word harness, which is exactly right. I use the word marshaled or co-opted. So as we I mean, Europeans are expanding around the world and encountering people from different continents and different nations. We are being exposed to people who are different from us. And at this point in history, what is now what we regard as pseudoscience, but at the time is natural philosophy or science itself, is being used to taxonomize or classify humans. But it's not classification in the sense that we think about it today in biology, because it is inherently hierarchical. And there are no taxonomies from this era, from the 17th century onwards until the 20th century, which are not hierarchical, with white Europeans being at the top of that hierarchy. So as you say, the primary determinant in the first versions of this, by people like Carl Linnaeus, whose taxonomic system is foundational in biology, I mean, still used today. Pigmentation comes first. He draws up four subspecies of humans, and they are Africanus, Europaeus, Asiaticus, and Americanus. And they roughly correspond to the sort of racial folk taxonomies that we have today. Skin color comes first, and following that comes a lot of value judgments, non-scientific and deeply, deeply racist value judgments about their laws, governed by caprice, lustful in some cases. I won't go into details because it's pretty offensive, but it's you know, it's in the book and it's easy to find out what they were. Whereas the Europeans are hardworking and inventive and industrious. And so there you have the basis of the structural racism that we endure today in the West, in America, and in Europe, is set up at a time of empire, a time of European expansionism, and science is being harnessed or co-opted or marshaled into this political ideology in order to justify the subjugation of people. Mm-hmm. So science is inherently tied in to the history of racism, of colonialism, and of the subjugation of people.
And then, so those notions fueled the, you know, institutions of slavery, of other racist institutions that have subjugated whole groups of people based on their skin color, that in turn today has left a legacy that we continue to struggle with. In some countries have not even properly acknowledged, such as in my country. But we also have these more modern notions of racism and racial and racist stereotypes. So you write in your book, you have an introduction that is quite updated for the coronavirus pandemic, where we, you know, since the pandemic was declared, we saw a huge uptick in racist incidents and hateful incidents aimed at East Asians in particular. Our President Donald Trump has referred to the Kung Flu, the Chinese virus, which has in turn fueled a lot of racist attacks against Chinese people. And so we have these more modern notions of racist stereotypes, but these seem to be just updated versions of our racist past, right?
Yes, I think that's true, in the sense that science is always, or misuse of science or pseudoscience is always through history harnessed in order to justify these kinds of bigotries, whether they're racist or sexist or any form of prejudice. And that seems to be the nature of things, that people like to have scientific crutches to support their bigotry. Now, even though racism as we currently endure it was founded by pseudoscientists of that era, the trajectory of my science, particularly genetics, you know, which has come via anthropology and via these early taxonomies in the 17th and 18th century, has been the one subject that has effectively undermined the biological notion of race. And that's why I think it's important that we have these types of conversations, because we're at a time via social media and via a sort of explosion in genetics and understanding of genetics, where my tools, my toys, are being used to justify continued bigotry. The COVID example is perfect for this, because it wasn't simply racialized in the sense of the provenance of the virus being from China. And incidentally, it's not just Chinese Americans that have been racially, physically attacked. Also, Korean Americans have been attacked in huge numbers, which I suppose, you know, it just demonstrates quite how irrational and idiotic this type of racial abuse is. But there was a second way that it was that COVID was racialized, which was that from very early on, both in the UK and in America, there's a disproportionately high infection and death rate for my country, for British and Asian people, in America, British Asian, Black and Asian and Latino Hispanic people. And immediately, as soon as this began to emerge, people started talking about the biological basis for this, that was this mediated by race? Does this demonstrate that there is a biological reality to race? And even proposing sort of well-intentioned, sort of vaguely scientific and possibly quite interesting from a sort of molecular biology level, explanations for this disparity that we're seeing. But the truth is that the disparity that we see in the racialization of COVID, it is no different from the racialization that we see in all forms of medicine. Those groups tend to be in lower socioeconomic status bands. They tend to live in urban areas. They tend to live in multi-generational families with older people there who are more susceptible to infection and to death. They tended to have key worker status jobs, which means that they weren't necessarily able to lock down or self-isolate. Now, all these factors are a much better explanation for the racial disparities that we see in COVID infections. And the reason I can say that with such confidence is because it's not unique to COVID. That is exactly what we see in pretty much every infectious disease. Medicine is racialized in the States and in the UK and in Western Europe and probably all over the world. And the fact that COVID had this racial character to it, this racialized character to it, is not unique to COVID at all. It's how medicine works in the Western world.
Right.
So it is just a continual leaning on science to say, oh, look, race is real, it's biologically real, and this justifies my prejudices or my stereotypes or my bigotry. But you can't do that. As soon as you scrape beneath the surface, it just falls apart.
So your book is called How to Argue with a Racist. I have a racist relative who never admits his racism, who claims to love his mixed race grandchildren, and yet will post on Facebook one video after another of a black person committing violence against white people, individual videos of individual incidents, never, of course, coincidentally stumbles across a violent incident where the white person is the perpetrator. How do you say to a person like that, that their actions are racist and that their incidents that they cite are not indicative of the racial group as a whole? I mean, it seems ridiculous to have to argue with a racist in 2020, but we have this resurgence thanks to people like Trump.
Yeah, and social media and the change in global politics, the rise of nationalism, and you know, in here in the UK it was Brexit, in the US it is Trump. I'm sorry to hear that, and you're right, you know, everyone has this, and social media exposes these wounds. I think the answer is calmly, and we like to think that better arguments will persuade people, but of course, you know, at the same time, there is the old Jonathan Swift maxim, which is which I will modernize now because I can't remember the 1721 version, which is that you can't reason someone out of a position that they didn't reason themselves into. And in some cases, I think you sort of dyed-in-the-wool racists are, you can't really argue with them, and there's no amount of evidence that you can present or no amount of arguments that you can present to someone whose bigotry is so fulfilled that will ever persuade them. But I think, you know, family members, the types of discussions which are held between people who aren't sort of overt racists, but maintain racialized or even racist views about stereotypes to do with sport or intelligence, or I think we have good psychological evidence that the best people to have the most effective way to persuade people out of the view that they hold is close family and networks that are trusted anyway, and networks that are loving. One thing I've definitely found over the years of being rather pugnacious and enjoying a good scrap is that you never persuade anyone by shouting at them. And I think that, you know, trust and reason but also evidence, you know, just slowly chipping away at the foundations of those sort of views. If your relative is posting these sorts of videos, you know, is it possible to engage with them and say, well, yes, this is, I understand that this is real, but look what you're doing here. You're selecting, you're confirming your biases and saying, I'm just going to post the ones that confirm what I already think. When actually, when you look at the data, these are the outliers, or the systemic racism that we experience in society means that the best correlate for violent crime is actually poverty. And the best correlate with poverty according is by racialized groups. And so, you know, getting stuck into the weeds about this, which is what science is all about. You know, you see things and you want to know why that is, and you keep digging and you keep digging. It's only when people stop when they think their biases are confirmed. And I think scientists don't stop until they think that they've pursued the truth. Right. So that's kind of the difference. And that's what I want to do in the book, is say, you know, here's your toolkit. Here are the stereotypes, here are the arguments, here are the racist views, and these are the tools that you might be able to use to dismantle those ideas.
Let's talk about how one makes or harnesses what we know from genetics about race, which is a big subject in your book. I mean, we have white supremacists or neo-Nazis today looking for racial purity. Is there such a thing as racial purity? I mean, there are people who look white, who have non-white ancestry, and vice versa.
Yeah, no is the answer. There is no such thing as racial purity, and yet it is the absolute key idea in white supremacy. You need to be able to demonstrate your ancestry is purely Northern European, so that there is purity in your lineage, and that is associated with superiority. Now, it is a nonsense. It is predicated on a belief system that has its roots in the 17th century with the things that we just talked about, the subjugation of people during expansionism. But what we know about genetics and what we know about genealogy and genetic genealogy, which are that they're related but slightly different concepts, is that we share the same ancestors after only a few generations. I noticed that with Kamala Harris being selected as Joe Biden's potential VP in the forthcoming elections, that already people are talking about ancestry, and she is, I think I'm right in saying that she's part Caribbean American,
Jamaican, and Indian. Her mother was Indian. Jamaican. Her father's a Jamaican.
Got it. And you know, the Wall Street Journal has an article saying that President Obama has ancestors who were slave traders or plantation owners. I only read the headline. And I read that and think, well, what? Yeah, so what? Because we all do, right? Every American has ancestors who are from all over the world, including white Europeans and black enslaved people, and they will include plantation owners, because you just need to go back a few generations and the number in our family tree just explodes. It just explodes, and the relatedness between them and us falls off a cliff. So I'm guessing from your surname that your ancestry is from India, right?
Yes, and I think you're also part Indian.
Right, yeah, but my Indian ancestry via my mother comes via Guyana, via this British form of slavery in the 19th century called indenture. Now that I can say this with almost complete confidence, that means that you and I, having never met, are probably fourth cousins, maybe fifth. It's just a fact of biology that this is how family trees work. The fact that I know that you have Indian ancestry just makes it much stronger for me and you. But most people on Earth are something like a 10th cousin, because that is how our family trees work. They branch out from us, they collapse in after a few generations, and then there comes a point after very few centuries where we're all descended from exactly the same people. So the concept of racial purity is just, it's a total myth, but it's very narratively satisfactory. And that's what humans really crave. You know, it's not very, if you're into genealogy and someone like me comes up and says, well, yeah, I know you've managed to identify one person in your family tree that goes back five generations, which is pretty cool. But by doing that, you're ignoring 31 other people, right, who you're equally descended from, you're equally related to. And what do? We just park them to the side and say, well, we don't know who they were, so forget those guys. I'm just going to focus on this one lineage. which shows some kind of concept of purity back for the arbitrary point that allows me to say that I have a pure race. It is a total nonsense.
So you're suggesting that those ancestry DNA tests that people do are really quite silly?
I have great reservations about the information that they provide. I think that the companies that provide them are the science itself is robust. They're looking at your DNA in a way which is verifiably accurate. I think it is the interpretation that comes with those ancestry testing kits which is problematic. Now, that's partly caveat emptor. That's partly the punters, the paying customers, are not sort of, you know, getting stuck into the subject of genetics, which is immensely complicated, to the level that they understand what it is actually that these tests are showing. And it's partly that the companies market them in very clever ways, which whilst not being dishonest, are not fully, you know, they don't say exactly what the tests do, because if they did, no one would buy them. So what they do is they play to our lowest common denominator, which is that we want meaning, we want to be part of this grand narrative of humankind. And I think, I believe that most people are not racist, and then discovering that they have roots from all over the world is very heartening for many people. It's, for the most part though, it's stuff that I could tell you without you having to spit in a tube and give me $100, although I'll take the $100 if you want. You can keep the spit. I'm fine with that. But it plays up to this narrative. We want to know who our ancestors was. We think it might tell us about who we are today. Well, I'm sorry, but if you're looking for those sorts of answers, your DNA isn't really going to provide you with satisfactions. And I say that as a geneticist. You know, it sounds like I've spent the last 20 years undermining my own subject.
So finally, what about the role of culture? We have race as a social construct, but culture is something that, you know, intersects with the issue of race. We all have our own communities, our own background, our own traditions, religions, etc. Do you have a view of how culture intersects with this notion of race?
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about here is identity. We're talking about personal identity and group identity, and sometimes that can be derived from ancestry. We're humans are tribal, right? We like our groups. The groups are very often sort of incoherent and overlapping, or, you know, sort of non-cohesive, because if you like a particular sports team, you can have great affiliation for a bunch of people that you're not particularly closely related to and feel that very passionately in your heart. I start the book by talking about my own sort of group identities, because I come from a particular part of the UK, which I love, but I haven't lived there for 20 years because I've been in London, because London is the most exciting city on earth. maybe New York, quite like Barcelona as well. But also, you know, I'm a scientist, but within science, I'm a geneticist, and within genetics, I'm interested in evolution, and I support Ipswich Town Football Club and the Chicago Bulls. And all of these are identities. All of these are identifying points that say, you know, this is who I am. None of them are overwhelming. The fact, you mentioned a minute ago how I have Indian ancestry. Well, that is true. My mother was born in Guyana and is descended from Indians who were indentured over there. But I wasn't raised by her. My parents split up when I was very little. So in fact, I have very little Indian cultural identity, apart from, as I always say in my lectures and in the book, apart from, like so many British people, an absolute adoration of both cricket and curry, two things that Indians do much better than British people. Now, does that mean I'm culturally Indian? Well, no, not really. It turns out that I have Native American ancestors as well, which is super cool.
Wow.
Right? That's a really cool thing to discover when we did our genealogy from the late 18th, early 19th century. A woman called Mary Huntley, who was imported, her father was imported to join the circus. And she's my great, 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 great grandmother. How cool is that? Does it mean I have any cultural identity with the Catawba tribe? No, of course not. She has probably hundreds of thousands of descendants in the UK and all over the world who cannot legitimately claim any either legal status as being Catawba or Native American or cultural whatsoever. So culture is so much more important in this identity than genetics, in a way that, again, sounds like I'm undermining my own subject. But it's just true. We're cultural beings. We're social and cultural beings, and those social interactions are what define us, not what's in ourselves.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Adam. Appreciate it, and good luck with the book.
Well, thank you, Sonali. It's really lovely to talk to you.
My guest has been Adam Rutherford. He's a geneticist, science writer, and broadcaster. We've been discussing his new book, How to Argue with a Racist, What Our Genes Do and Don't Say About Human Difference. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.